Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with this Labor Day weekend celebrations and examine the state of working America with the author of the annual report by that name that is considered the authoritative text on the American workforce. Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute and principal author of The State of Working America, joins us to discuss his latest report, A Decade of Flat Wages, The Key Barrier to Shared Prosperity and a Rising Middle Class. Then we will speak with Matthew O'Brien, an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers business and economics. We will discuss his article at The Atlantic, Who Are the Long-Term Unemployed?, and profile the 4 million people who are the long-term unemployed, Americans who can't find work for 6 months or more, who tend to be more educated but a little older, and can't even get companies to look at their resumes anymore. Then finally, we'll examine the status of women in the labor force with Heidi Hartman, the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, and discuss the paradox that women are now the primary breadwinners in almost half of America's households, but at the top, in the boardrooms of corporate America, the glass ceiling is firmly intact. And joining us now is Lawrence Michel, who is president of the Economic Policy Institute. He's the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled A Decade of Flat Wages, The Key Barriers to Shared Prosperity and a Rising Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Michel.
Thanks a lot, Ian. Glad to be here again.
And on this Labor Day, Lawrence, Michel, let's start with the middle class itself and the definition of the middle class, and indeed whether, you know, the middle class is what the president seems to claim it is, since he is addressing the middle class and middle class issues all the time. And the more recent reports, excerpts of which were in the AP recently, that indicated that 4 out of 5 Americans experienced poverty and job insecurity and had to go on government programs, indicating that there may be more people in the working class than the middle class. So what's your definition of the middle class?
Well, the economics doesn't define this, and neither does the Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Basically, most Americans think they're in some part of the middle class, those who explicitly don't think they're poor, and those who don't think that they're very rich. And people don't think they're very rich unless they feel that they can spend money without ever thinking about it. And that's very few people. So in the American culture, most everybody seems to be think they're middle class, although it is true that a lot of people will identify in surveys that they are working class, and I think that is actually a rising share.
So what are the politics behind this? Is it more comfortable for the president to refer always to the middle class and not to working Americans? Have we reached a point with the decades of the demonization of working Americans and the very word working, which has connotations of the working class, which then arcs back to the Cold War communism? I mean, in other words, are politicians afraid to talk about the working class and working Americans?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think, the language being adopted these days is talk about the middle class and those who aspire to join the middle class. And, a lot of people will talk about working families and such. As you noted, our book is called The State of Working America. And I think, that does describe, most everybody who's not yet retired.
So in terms of having established the moving line between the working class or the working Americans and the middle class, what's your sense then of what's happened this last week with the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington? And so much of that, of course, was really about a march for people, for justice for all races. And is there a sense that we may eventually start to coalesce in this country, not so much around race, but around class? In other words, do we need affirmative action based upon class as opposed to race?
Well, I believe that, that one has to think about both race, class, and for that matter, gender when thinking about people. In part, it's because of how people think of themselves. And a lot of people view themselves first and foremost through a race and ethnic lens. But I do think that we do have, many, many class issues and all the issues of stagnant wages and rising inequality that, you know, you have covered many times in this show. And I think that we are seeing a coalescing of groups that deal with these issues. In fact, next week in Los Angeles is the convention of the AFL-CIO, and under consideration is a very formal affiliation of the various civil rights groups with the AFL-CIO. And I see that these civil rights groups and the labor groups moving much more in concert together and working together. And in fact, if you went to the march that was commemorating the march 50 years ago, this which would have been a week ago Saturday, it was sponsored by many unions along with civil rights groups. So I do think I do see that these folks are moving together, and I think that's a very good sign.
So would this be the way to revive the labor movement, do you think, Lawrence Michel, is a bottom-up resurgence?
Well, I think it's going to take a lot. Some of it would take change the law, and some of it is about gaining political power. And I think that the way to do that is to build as broad a coalition as you can. And I think that's why there is an interest of labor working together with civil rights groups. I mean, listen, the AFL-CIO has more minority members than any of the civil rights groups themselves, because they're very large organizations, the AFL-CIO unions. So there's a lot of common ground. And I think that it's going to take a lot of a big coalition, and expanding that coalition to be able to have the political presence that's going to change the economic policies that will permit us to have a shared prosperity going forward, because that's clearly something that hasn't been happening. There haven't been hardly any group of workers that have moved ahead in the last 10 years. And the reason why I emphasize 10 years is that it's not just the period after the recession and the financial crisis and the miserably slow recovery that we had. During the last business cycle recovery from 2002 to 2007, we also didn't see any wage growth faster than inflation for workers, whether they be college grads, white-collar workers, blue-collar workers, high school grads. Wages have been dead in the water for a decade for just about everybody.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Michel, who is the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He's the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. And his latest report is titled, A Decade of Flat Wages, the Key Barrier to Shared Prosperity and a Rising Middle Class. So given that we've had this lots decade in wages and on the heels of decades of inadequate wage growth or flat wages, essentially going from basically the end of the 1970s. Is there, do you think, a political awakening going on, or do we have an inherent problem here with our lawmakers and with Washington, in as much as the flow of money is such that money has captured our politics? And do our representatives, do you think, adequately represent the working Americans and the endangered middle class?
Well, I think we have a number of problems. I mean, one is that there is a tremendous power of money in politics, and that helps set what gets voted on, what the agenda is. It helps set what the media talks about, and sets what can pass in terms of legislation. But We have more problems than that. I think our organizations that have constituencies are, like unions, like civil rights groups, like many community organizations, are too small and need to be bigger and stronger. I think that most people have tremendously low expectations, and I don't think we're going to make many progressive advances when people don't believe that much at all is possible. I think at this point, families are hunkered down just hoping that they just survive the current economic crisis. And they're not really expecting to move ahead. They just don't want to fall further behind. They have low expectations for their children. And I think that's really quite remarkable and quite problematic because our economy has created much income and wealth over the last generation. Our economy will produce a lot of income and wealth going forward, and we need to have policy changes to make sure that the vast majority actually benefit from an expanded economy. But if people have such low expectations, I don't think we're going to get there. So I think they need to see some victories. They think they need to see organizations that are mobilizing on their behalf. And I think it'll be very catching that if there is some movement, I think if there are some victories, I think people will rally.
So one of the things, Lawrence Michel, that has exploded in cost since the mid-80s, and we just were talking about earlier how wages have been flat since the late 70s, but in terms of household expenses, the greatest expense that's increased over fivefold is the cost of education and the cost of college. And the president has been trying to deal with that lately on a bus tour, et cetera. But you have these rackets like the for-profit college racket that's soaking up, I think, $50 billion or $60 billion worth of taxpayer money with these frauds like Donald Trump's latest Trump University that's now being investigated. So you have people on Wall Street that are making out like bandits on these fundamentals to the building blocks of a middle-class society, and which the president himself said on his bus tour of the Northeast that this is the gateway into the middle class. So would that be a place to start, to clean up this racket?
Well, there's always room to make people better off by making the things they really need more accessible and cheaper. I mean, that's what the health care reform is about. I thought you were going to bring up health care when you were talking about something that was rising in price. So,
but that's only been rising threefold compared to education that's risen fivefold.
Education has been rising a lot. Maybe not as much as the sticker price, but certainly a lot. And I think we do need to find a way to provide more access to college for more people. I think that's the only way we'll get social mobility, where low-income and working-class families who have children, you know, need to be able to get the most education and training they can in order to have their shot at a good job. I think equally important is making sure that the jobs we have are good. I think the emphasis about college is worthwhile to give everyone a chance, but it's also true that right now one-third of the workforce has a college degree or more, two-thirds don't. Something like that share is going to be the way it's going to be 10 years from now. We need to make sure that people who don't have a college degree also can earn a decent living. And it's also the case that even having a college degree is no big guarantee anymore. As I said, you know, wages for college graduates haven't grown for 10 years. And that's true even for those who are, you know, in management occupations and business occupations, including, you know, people who are in science and technology and engineering occupations. So there is no real guarantee of moving ahead anymore. Having a college degree, you'll end up better off than if you don't, but it doesn't guarantee you a rising standard of living either.
So, of course, our history shows the ebbs and flows of plutocratic control, and then popular movements arise from the original, going back to the original Gilded Age, and then you had the accidental presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, who was a reformer, and then you had the trust busting. So you had, there was a sense that there was more social justice, and then you had the Great Depression that made a slow and painful comeback, where there was more and more social justice, more focus on building a middle class under Roosevelt, reaching its zenith just after World War II with the GI Bill. And at that point, America was, for all intents and purposes, a social democracy like the Europeans. So what happened to that momentum, do you think?
Well, we shouldn't overstate it. There were a lot of people left out of that.
Right, right. But African Americans and Latinos were invisible in those days. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, but I think you know the general trend is what you're saying. And well, I think that there was a counter mobilization in the 1970s by those with the most wealth and power. I think people interested in this should read a book by Jacob Hacker and Frank Pearson called Winner Take All Politics. It lays it out pretty clearly that the business community decided that it wanted to blunt what was the the trend. You know, we were having more civil rights, more rights for women, environmental regulations, more consumer protections, unions were strong. And they were concerned about their level of profitability, and they mobilized against it, both intellectually, through academia and think tanks, on the ground politically, and gradually, gained through political power, made changes in the way we regulate our economy to make sure that those with the most got the biggest share of the pie going forward. And they were very successful. And what's we talked about earlier is one of the things that happened is when you have this vast increase in income inequality, wealth inequality, it also reinforces political inequalities, which makes it that much more difficult to get any kind of political change that will benefit the vast majority. So that's a thumbnail about what happened. But I don't think we should think that it has to be this way. As I pointed out, we do have a democracy. People can vote. People can mobilize. If people recognize that there is a lot of income and wealth being produced, that there's no reason why they shouldn't share in it, that they can implement the policies. They can make it easier for people to join a union and get collective bargaining. We can raise the minimum wage. We can provide sick days to people. We can provide vacation days to people. We can make work-family balance much more easy to navigate. There's lots of things that we can do in this very, very rich country if people have the expectations and they mobilize to make that happen.
Well, finally, Lawrence Michel, on this Labor Day, ironically, it takes a billionaire to one of the richest men in the world to make the point, as Warren Buffett did, that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy. And where do you see the political leadership coming from? If we have a businessman that's warning us, where is somebody on the political left, do you think, in terms of a community organizer, shall I say?
Well, I think that there are a lot of organizations that are there to challenge the status quo. I mean, the labor movement and MoveOn.org, and there's community organizations in every city. I think the civil rights groups, I think a lot of organizations. So I think that there is a nucleus to build on, and I think it's really important to find ways to energize people and have them mobilize to make changes in their local community, in their state, and ultimately in federal policy.
Well, Lawrence Michel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Michel, who's the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He is the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. And his latest report is titled A Decade of Flat Wages, The Key Barrier to Shared Prosperity in a Rising Middle Class. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the long-term unemployed.
I share with you. Tissue paper swinging pendulums. Anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. You're good as dead without a bank account. But it's funny how a life you felt down in that unemployment line with all that trash.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew O'Brien, who's an associate editor at The Atlantic, covering business and economics. His latest article at The Atlantic is, Who Are the Long-Term Unemployed? Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew O'Brien.
Great to be here.
And on this Labor Day weekend, of course, people are talking, we are talking about labor and how it's lost its power and clout over the years, particularly in terms of its importance to the Democratic Party. And unemployment, of course, is a real factor in or a consequence. But it seems from reading your article, Matthew, that so much of the pain that you're talking about from these highly qualified people who can't get work and are the long-term unemployed, it seems like the 2008 crash started this disaster. Is that what you got from your interviews?
Yeah. Well, in 2008, we had for the first time since basically the 1930s, a large class of people in the U.S. who have been out of work, have been looking for work, and haven't been able to find any for long periods of time. That's something that has happened in Europe in the 1980s for a bit, and it's something that economists have studied. It's what they call structural unemployment, a rise in what economists call the natural rate of unemployment. That means how much unemployment can an economy have before inflation starts picking up. So in the U.S., there's no sign yet that this is structural, but there's the danger that it could be if we don't get people back to work soon. And so right now, there are about 4.2 million people who have been out of work and still looking for the last 6 months at least. And of those, most of those are people who have been out of work for a year or more. And that's about 40% of the total group of unemployed people. So it's a huge percentage, and it's a huge problem.
And this involuntary retirement, as you remark with some irony, is this, do you think, in other words, did the labor market and the employers take advantage of the crash in as much as people that are being hired now to replace these long-term unemployed? My understanding is quite more often than not, they're younger, less educated, and they come in the door a hell of a lot cheaper.
Well, that's certainly part of it. There are a lot of different factors working against the long-term unemployed right now. If you look at the numbers, about half of them are people who got laid off from their last job. Now, when you think about who's unemployed, you think, oh, it's everyone who's been laid off. But there are a lot more people in the pool of unemployed than just that. There are people who are looking for their first job, or maybe they were staying at home for a while, and now they're looking for a job again. So if you look at who the long-term unemployed are, they're mostly people who, A, got laid off, B, they do tend to be older. And then the third factor there is that a lot of times companies won't even look at their resumes. So companies, you know, there might be a stigma to getting laid off, and they don't want to hire those people. And then once you've been out of work for 6 months or longer, a lot of companies have they have software that filters out people who have been out of work for 6 months or longer, and they won't even consider you unless everyone else that they have doesn't pan out. And so it becomes this trap where you can't get out. And, you know, policymakers aren't really doing anything about it.
Well, it seems extraordinary to think that, I mean, you in other words, if you were, not that you could get an interview, if they don't even look at your resume, but assuming you get an interview, it doesn't help you to say, well, I'm a victim of the recession?
No, it really doesn't. It's tremendously difficult to even get an interview. You know, companies assume that if you've been out of work this long, something must be wrong with you. And again, as I mentioned, there's, you know, new software that just, they have large piles of resumes and they need to get through them quickly. And so they just filter out people who've been out of work that long. And so you're left with a situation where people who are maybe in their 40s or 50s who have good experience and good work history can't even get an interview. And at that point, they only keep looking because they have unemployment insurance. And you have to keep looking to get unemployment insurance. But as unemployment insurance gets cut, then they have less reason to even keep looking. So it gets cut because as the unemployment rate falls, the length of the maximum benefit falls automatically. So right now unemployment has fallen for the last year. And so because of that, the average benefit, or the longest benefit you can get, has fallen from 99 to 93 down to about 63 weeks on average right now. And for some states, it's much lower than that. North Carolina made headlines because they spurned federal unemployment benefits and they cut their maximum length to 19 weeks. So if you're long-term unemployed and you're only looking for a job, you've basically given up, but you keep looking because that's how you get unemployment insurance. Well, now you can't get that, so then you stop looking. So then unemployment falls, but not really, because there's still people who have no lifeline, basically, who no one will hire. And we kind of say, oh, well, I guess we've done our job because unemployment's fallen.
Well, that certainly appears to be the case, that the White House has been celebrating the unemployment's going down. And, well, as somebody who follows the economy, Matthew O'Brien, again, associate editor at The Atlantic covering business and economics, his latest article at The Atlantic is Who Are the Long-Term Unemployed? In terms of laying the blame here, you've got, on the one hand, I guess, premature celebration on the part of the White House, who aren't dealing with the tragedy of these people who are, based upon what you just told us, they essentially drop into poverty. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem like the Republicans want this recovery to work. So you're there in this town beset with gridlock. What's your analysis of why, you know, not just healthcare has become a political football, but unemployment itself, you know, why the lack of compassion?
Well, on the one hand, you've got Republicans who overwhelmingly talk about the unemployed and people who are on food stamps who might have a job but are low income. They talk about these people as if they're lazy, as if it's their fault. So House Republicans want to drug test food stamps. And Florida tried this 2 years ago because they thought it would save money, because they would kick off people who tested positive for drugs. Well, it turned out that very few people tested positive. Ended up costing the state of Florida more money than it saved administering all these drug tests, because people are out of work right now, not because they're lazy, but because the economy is still terrible. And we just had the worst crisis we've had in 80 years. The idea that people aren't working because the safety net's too cushy, or, you know, they're fun employed, it's ridiculous. So on the one hand, you've got the Republicans who don't have a ton of sympathy for the unemployed. On the other hand, you've got the Democrats who would like to do more, but when they had a chance to do more in 2009, they didn't do enough. Then after that, stimulus became a four-letter word, and so they kind of just hoped that the recovery would take off, and they've been looking for any sign that it is. And we really haven't gotten the kind of catch-up growth we need to get people back to work. And so we're stuck in this equilibrium where the long-term unemployed or long-term employment looks like it's falling. If you look in the last year, it's fallen by about 900,000 people. But we've only created, I want to say, about 1.5 million jobs. There's no way that most or even a significant percentage of those jobs are going to long-term unemployed people. They're just falling off the unemployment insurance benefits rolls. And it looks like long-term unemployment is falling, but those are becoming discouraged workers who have just given up.
So going back to the 2009 stimulus, which at the time people like Nobel economist Paul Krugman and others argued that it was far too little, and it's always struck me as an extraordinary fact that had that stimulus been more robust and had they not made that deal with diluting it with so many tax cuts, then wouldn't Obama be in much better shape and the Democrats be in much better shape? So I guess the question goes to why did they take the, you know, the lowball route and not, you know, when they had that trifecta, they had, after all, they had the presidency, the Senate, and the House, it would seem that they were in the position to push this through and they'd be out of the woods now. I've always been mystified by that. Did you have any particular wisdom on the thinking that went into that?
I think there were two things there. I think first, Obama's political team didn't think they could get much more stimulus through Congress. They thought that Senate Democrats would balk at $1 trillion price tag. And it wasn't just diluted with tax cuts, which weren't as good as, say, infrastructure spending, but it was also diluted with things that weren't even stimulus. They had this AMT patch where they had to fix the fact that people would be pushed into this alternative minimum tax. And that was about 70 billion out of the 787 billion. So that's not stimulus at all. So A, they thought the politics wouldn't work, and then B, they didn't realize how big the hole was at the time. In 2008, in the last quarter of the year, the initial estimate for how much the economy was falling was 3.8%. And then that got revised up to, I think, 9.8%. So the hole was much deeper than they realized, and they didn't think they could do more politically. And then once they realized, a couple months down the road, that things were worse than they had hoped, the politics was bad enough that they were too afraid to go back for a second stab at it. And on top of that, the Federal Reserve's been timid. It's been less timid lately, but the Republicans have attacked Ben Bernanke and the rest of the Fed for trying to bring down unemployment. It's been the only institution in Washington that's been trying for the last couple of years.
Well, but does that mean that the Republicans have an investment in unemployment?
I don't think it's necessarily cynical. I think that they think these things are bad for the economy, even though there's very little evidence at this point. All of their talking points about inflation and runaway interest rates and this idea that there's a magical red line at 90% of debt to GDP, none of these things have been borne out. All of them have been debunked. But they really haven't changed their tune, and they don't really have any new ideas, and they're kind of floundering around looking for new ones.
But the one thing that they agree on is to stymie Obama, right? I mean, that seems to be what it's about. I mean, when we just got through talking about how Obama had his chance back when he came in, but now he can't get anything done. I mean, all he can do is make speeches, right?
Right. I mean, with the divided Congress, there's very little that's going to get done, and there's probably going to be divided Congress for quite some time. The House Republicans have a very durable advantage in terms of just some of it's gerrymandering, some of it's just where people live. And so because of those things, it's very unlikely they're going to lose their majority in the House anytime soon.
Well, if North Carolina is the petri dish, then if the Republicans take the Senate, presumably they'll have more political power and be able to pursue some more of these policies that, seem to be. I mean, that's the part of it that I find extraordinary, that when you mention what's happening in North Carolina, where they just, refuse the federal money, but the people who are punished are the poor. And I just wonder, in this week where people have been celebrating Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, there's not much compassion out there anymore, it would seem.
No, there really isn't. People who have been out of work for a long time don't have a lot of political power. They don't have a lobby. They're not visible. And so it's easy for politicians to ignore them. The Republicans don't seem to have a lot of compassion for ideological reasons. They think that people who have been out of work are probably just being coddled too much, and that cutting the safety net will give them financial incentives to get a job, even though there aren't jobs available. And on the Democratic side, there's just very little motivation to talk about things that aren't broadly to do with the middle class. They know they can't achieve anything right now because government's divided, so there's not much in it for them to talk about this. So it just kind of gets forgotten.
Well, there was a recent study, Matthew O'Brien, that indicated that our notions about the middle class may be extremely exaggerated, and that I think something like 80% of working Americans, including the middle class, at some point or other, experience unemployment and need government services. And so do you think that I know the middle class is a kind of mantra for the White House, but how much of a myth is it?
Well, I mean, if you look at Obama's approval ratings right now, they're falling significantly just from the beginning of the year. So I think that people are still very unhappy with the bad economy, and if they could do anything, they should, but they can't. So they're stuck in this position where all they can do is try to make the Republicans look worse. And that's basically what they've been doing since 2010. And the question is, are they going to go for another stab at a so-called grand bargain, which they might in September? The question there is, they have to come up with a new budget for the government, or continue to pay for the government, not a budget. And they need to raise the debt ceiling again, same thing that happened in 2011. The Republicans have said they might not do that. They've made some noise about trying to maybe defund Obamacare and use that as their leverage, the threat of a government default or default on our obligations, either one. So a lot of questions about what's going to happen in just the next month or so. You know, there are some Senate Republicans, and maybe the White House, too, hope to use this to come to a deal that would replace the sequester, maybe cut Social Security benefits a little bit, replace the sequester cuts with other cuts that are smarter than what we have now. So there are a lot of balls in the air and a lot of potential outcomes just in the next 30 days.
Well, just in closing, Matthew O'Brien, is there, I mean, in this week of celebrating the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's famous I Had a Dream speech and the March on Washington, I was listening to a Martin Luther King speech the other day at the time, and he was talking about the Vietnam War, of course, and the resources it was draining and how it sort of undermined the war on poverty. And he talked about unemployment and how much of the unemployment, of course, is black unemployment. But he was talking about figures that are half of what we have now. And that was alarming at the time, 4%. So what's your sense of how this might be a permanent condition in as much as you were saying earlier that the jobs aren't there? Well, what is going to bring back the jobs? Maybe they're not going to come back.
I think eventually they will, but you look around the world and there are plenty of examples of countries that have made mistakes and kept making them for a long time. Japan went through, you know, a very similar crisis to what we went through back in the early 1990s, and they had what they call a lost decade. And that lost decade has really been one and a half lost decades. In the early 2000s, they grew pretty well. But aside from that, you know, 15 of the last 20 years have been pretty bad for them. So it's not a sure thing that the economy will bounce back if people in charge keep making mistakes. And right now, we've kind of defined down success to the point where people who are out of work, we're just kind of abandoning them. And if we do that, then yeah, things could be bad for people for a long time. And that's the scary thing.
Well, just in closing, though, the other example, so if you look at Europe, for example, youth unemployment is extraordinary. Over 50% in Spain and in Greece, and average in a lot of these countries are about 20%. I mean,
Europe seems pretty determined to repeat Japan's mistakes. We're a little less determined, but not enough so. But, you know, Europe is certainly looking at a lost decade, if not more, unless they drastically change what they're doing, and there's no sign that they will. We've done better than that, but not better enough.
Right, and we would have done a lot worse if we'd listened to the deficit hawks and, the Republicans crying for more austerity. I mean, do you think that finally that lesson's been learned?
I think the austerity obsession has passed a bit. The deficit is coming down very fast right now, too fast. A lot of the studies that have, where the intellectual support for austerity have been debunked. And at this point, I think Republicans are beginning to realize that being the party of austerity isn't going to win them the presidency. They need a positive vision for how to help people's, middle-class people. They're realizing that, but they still haven't come up with that agenda. It remains to be seen if they will.
Well, Matthew O'Brien, I thank you very much for joining us on this Labor Day weekend.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew O'Brien, who's an associate editor at The Atlantic, covering business and economics. His latest article at The Atlantic is Who Are the Long-Term Unemployed? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the status of women in the labor force.
Having a hard time in this crazy town. Having a hard time. There's no love to be found. Having a hard time in this crazy town.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Heidi Hartmann, who's the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that does women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartmann is also a research professor at the George Washington University, and her areas of expertise are women and the economy, workforce participation, employment, pay equity, retirement security, and she frequently testifies before the U.S. Congress. She's the vice chair of the National Council on Women's Organizations and co-editor of the Journal of Women, Politics and Policy, and a co-author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earnings Gap, Unnecessary Losses, Costs to Americans of the Lack of Family and Medical Leave, and Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heidi Hartmann.
Pleasure to be with you.
And on this Labor Day weekend, it does seem ironic that a recent poll by the Pew Research Institute found that a record 40% of all households with children under the age of 18 include mothers who are either the sole or primary source of income for the family. And this, of course, has been referred to as the breadwinner mums. Yet at the top in corporate America, the glass ceiling is intact. So there you have this extraordinary irony that women are holding up almost half the world at the bottom, but at the top, they're almost invisible.
Yes, it is a very unfortunate irony. I think part of the reason we've seen that growth of breadwinner moms in the last few years in the United States is that we really haven't had the job growth that we need after the very serious recession in 2007-2009, so quite a few husbands are unemployed. Quite a few men and women aren't marrying because of the lack of income, particularly on the male side. And so this leaves women, you know, supporting children on their own more than they used to. And they are gaining in the sense of having gained college education and preparation, and a great many of these mothers have graduated from college, which is a wonderful thing. And I do think that will continue to propel women into the labor market and continue to increase their earnings in the future. But it does take two very often to have a decent standard of living, and it's hard for the women to do it alone, especially when they haven't been to college, and as many have not. They have high school or a couple of years of college, and that really, unfortunately, makes them earn about the same as a guy would earn with only high school or not even high school. I mean, even with all that education, women still are not earning as much as men.
So it obviously has become an economic necessity over the decades. And since the 1970s, wages have essentially been flat in the United States. How, as a society, are we dealing with this change, this massive societal change brought upon by economic necessity? And conservatives argue that it's a terrible thing, that we should have stay-at-home moms, but they don't want to talk about the economic necessity.
Yes, exactly. It is, in fact, true that men's real wages have been flat since the early 70s. You know, they move up and down a little bit, and they were finally growing a bit, but then in the recession, this last recession, they got clobbered again. So they remained flat. However, over that time period, women's real wages actually have gone up a little, and it is due to the fact that they increased their education. And even if you don't increase your education, if you work more and you stay in the labor market more, you increase your earnings because, you know, most of us economists believe that as you gain job experience, gain human capital, your earnings do increase. But what you're referring to, that's the way we've dealt with that flat earnings for men. We've dealt with that by having more women enter the labor force, more wives in particular, more married women are helping to support families because the men's earnings have not risen over time the way they used to. And of course, you know, we economists say, well, we're not exactly sure why, but wage growth seems to have detached from productivity growth. It always used to be productivity would go up and wages would go up. Everyone would share and that prosperity from wage growth, but we don't see that for the last 40 years, really.
And that, of course, is one of the most compelling graphs that I've ever seen, is a graph that I think the New York Times published some years back of how household incomes and productivity were running in parallel all the way up until about the 1980s. And then around the 2000 mark, they really diverged radically. So all the rewards from increased productivity have gone to capital and not to labor. And that is...
capital into very high earners, managers who are, you know, at the top of the corporations and are also capitalists because they're being rewarded with stock options. Yes, I think that's correct.
And just this last week, of course, we had fast food workers across the country striking for or demonstrating for livable wages. McDonald's workers make a little more than $8 an hour. And what I find interesting is that there's another fast food chain called In-N-Out that pay more, something over $10 per hour, and pay quite good benefits to their employees and to their executives compared to McDonald's. And they're a thriving business, In-N-Out. So I don't understand why American capitalists don't show a little more compassion, because you get rewarded for compassion, it would seem.
Well, I think that's true. I think you get rewarded in bigger growth, higher profits, because you have good workers who are happy, more productive, customers happier. We have some examples. I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. We have a wonderful chain of restaurants called Busboys and Poets, where those workers all get health insurance and paid sick days. Many, as you probably know, many restaurant workers do not get paid sick days. That means they cannot or feel they cannot stay home when they're sick, and they're basically spreading germs in the kitchens on the food they're serving you because of this, you know, sort of relentless short-run view, oh, that must be more profitable. But in the long run, I think you're right, that's not more profitable. We have a lot of examples of that. I think a higher minimum wage would be excellent. In Australia, the minimum wage is somewhere around $16 or $18 an hour. Some of our political leaders are proposing about $10 an hour. But these fast food workers that were out demonstrating on the 29th, they are asking for $15 an hour. And that $15 an hour could include health insurance, so the cash wage could be a little less, and the health insurance would make up the difference between the cash wage and the $15. But, you know, if Australia can go to $16, $18 an hour, there's really no reason we can't do it here.
Well, Heidi Hartman is again the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that does women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartman's also a research professor at George Washington University, and she is the author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earnings Gap, Unnecessary Losses Cost to Americans of the Lack of Family and Medical Leave, and Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. So, I mean, we could get into a discussion, I guess, on this Labor Day weekend about why it is that other countries in Europe, Australia, you've mentioned, have social democracy, and why social democracy that started to take root after World War II has been assaulted and diminished. And even it takes a wealthy capitalist like Warren Buffett to say that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy. What explains the mentality on the part of American capitalists who have been the beneficiaries of this system? They've essentially captured our politics and control our economy, and many people argue that we are less of a democracy and more of an oligarchy. So what makes American capitalists different from, say, the Germans, who, by the way, under law, half of the seats on big corporations are given to labor leaders?
Well, I do think we could have some more social democracy, which would involve more power for workers. Instead, here we've had a real attack on unions, and unions have lost their share of the American workforce. We still have some unionized workers, fortunately. I think that it's awfully hard to, you know, figure out exactly why the U.S. is different, but I do think that we had this freedom mentality, individual freedom. You could always move west if you didn't like the government. I think Europe has a long history of having a lot of government and corporatist views, by which I mean collective or societal views of caring for the poor and lots of other things. Social Security started there earlier, for example. health insurance became nationalized during or after World War II, and in some countries before World War II. So it's pretty universal over there, and I believe we need to catch up, which we're doing now. One of the things about having such a strong, you could say big, low-wage labor market here, which the other countries don't have, is that women are stuck in that low-wage labor market. They're disproportionate share of the minimum wage workers, disproportionate share of the part-time workers. They find it very difficult in this country to combine work and family responsibilities, and one way they do that is by working part-time. In these European countries we've been talking about, you're much more likely to see that the women over there have paid family leave, sometimes up to a year or two for each child, and they have paid sick days, of course, and they have subsidized child care. So the whole society there is geared to making it easier for families to survive at a decent standard of living and making it easier for women to earn a decent wage, because when you do have subsidized child care, when you do have paid family leave, then when you're working, you can devote yourself to the job with confidence. You move up on the job, you earn more because you have a stable child care situation, because you know you can stay home if you or your child is sick and you don't have to worry about it. So this is, these countries are models, not just in the extent to which they have a greater degree of equality because they have stronger labor unions, stronger labor laws, more control of corporations than we have here, but also because they're providing more family support than we are.
So Heidi Hartman, again, the president of the Washington Mason Institute for Women's Policy Research. Is there a reason why we are more passive? Could a reason be that we appear to be more passive in our politics? For example, in France, every time the government even hints about taking away the social safety net and the generous benefits that people get where they operate on the simple logic of social democracy, which is you pay your taxes and your politicians are the stewards of that public money, and in return for you paying taxes, you get government services. And what few services we get are under assault politically, like Social Security, which everybody pays for, and Medicare, etc. And the American people do not appear to want to defend what they have with any political vigor. And furthermore, the conservatives in this country are operating on a jihad against Obamacare. And Obama recently asked rhetorically, saying that the only unifying principle that the Republicans seem to have is this notion of wanting to deny 30 million Americans health care, that that's their holy grail.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate, that attack on health care, which I see personally as such a great step forward. But I would not attribute it to the passivity of the American people. First of all, the French seem to be unusual, even in Europe, and I do admire their politics. And they do have a very different idea there. They do pay much more taxes than we do, and they get more from the government, and they expect to get more from the government. But I think we have a lot of activism here. Of course, we just had a few days ago the big march on Washington, the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March. We have lots of demonstrations all the time. We've just been talking about the food service workers going out. I think we have a lot of grassroots activity in many, many communities. It often doesn't bubble up to the level of national news, and I do think we have fair amount of concentration of the news media here. It's a good thing that we now have blogs and all kinds of web-based places to get information, so I think that's helped democratize people's access to what's going on a little bit. We just have a new news media, Al Jazeera America, for example, is a new one coming online on television. I think it is definitely a different politics here. But I wouldn't say that the American people are passive. I think there's quite a lot of people now organizing about Social Security. They're very, very concerned that the Republicans and the Democrats, the Obama administration and the Congress might make a deal that could cut Social Security benefits just right now, just as part of the continuing resolution to keep the government going after September 30th, as part of needing to lift our debt ceiling. They're very afraid that the cost of living adjustment to Social Security will be reduced, and there's quite a lot of organizing around that. There have been quite a few demonstrations at town hall meetings that Republicans have held, you know, when congressmen hold meetings in their homes areas during this month of recess. They're often working back at home, holding those meetings. There have been protesters out at many of those meetings. So I don't think it's that Americans don't want these programs and don't want to defend them, but I think there is a confusion in people's mind about, you know, what we're paying for and what we should be getting. And we need, I think, more clarity about what our taxes do pay for, what we should get for them. And the fact is that we pay those taxes for Social Security, for example, and that's our money. The government, technically, legally, the government is holding that money in trust for us. So that's just one example where I think people could have a greater understanding of how Social Security actually works.
Well, indeed, the argument is always that we pay too much taxes, which is not true. We pay the least amount of most of the advanced countries on the planet. The argument should be about what we get back for our taxes. In other words, the argument should be not about big government or too much government, but it should be about better government. And hopefully that will begin to happen. And I thank you for joining us, Heidi Hartmann, on this Labor Day weekend.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Heidi Hartmann, who's the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that does women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartmann is also a research professor at the George Washington University, and her areas of expertise are women and the economy, workforce participation, employment, pay equity, retirement security, and she's frequently testified before the United States Congress and is the vice chair of the National Council on Women's Organizations and co-editor of the Journal of Women, Politics, and Policy, and a co-author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earnings Gap, Unnecessary Losses, Costs to Americans of the Lack of Family and Medical Leave, and Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was